What is nice is that when I take another instrument, it's, the first steps you take on the new instruments, you're making like huge progress. So it's like, it's great. It's just like, oh, I'm getting better, really. While on the banjo, if I want to get, a little bit better, it takes a lot of work. So it's like sometimes it's good to, when if I decide to work on a piece on a mandolin, and then I can, after a few minutes, I can play it just like, oh wow, that's cool. On the banjo, if I want to learn something new, it's a challenge, but that's what makes it interesting too.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. This podcast strives to inspire you through the personal stories of a diversity of musicians worldwide, with in-depth conversations and great music that reveal the depth and breadth to a life in music. Guy Donis grew up in Belgium, where he had fallen in love with the banjo and proceeded to dedicate his life to it. In this episode, he describes how he taught himself a five-string banjo, learned about bluegrass, and expanded his musical horizons by collaborating with jazz and classical musicians. He immigrated to Canada many years ago and is well known in the Montreal music scene. He's toured Canada extensively with Notre Dame de Grasse and other bands, and in this episode he talks about his newest project, the Montreal Bluegrass League, and a track from their latest album is included in this podcast. Some tracks from his two trio albums are also included earlier in this episode, in which you can hear Guy's progressive jazz-influenced original music. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast. And I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com, where you can sign up for my weekly newsletter to get access to sneak peeks for upcoming guests. Please do share this episode with your friends and consider supporting the series by buying me a coffee. The link is in the description. Now to the episode. Hi, Guy. Thanks so much for joining me here today.
My pleasure.
It's so interesting to me that you're a bluegrass player when you're from Belgium.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. I admit that. Well, it's you never know why all of a sudden an instrument just catch your attention. It's I come from a musician family, and I've tried several instruments in my youth, and one day I saw a banjo player and I was fascinated for some reason. You never know why exactly.
What was the context? Was it a concert or at a cafe?
We were in a community cottage, kind of, and so all people from all around Belgium or even Europe could come there and stay there for the night. There was like maybe 10, 15 rooms, and then we were used to go there really often with my parents. It was part of her organization, it was and so one day somebody showed up there with a banjo, and my father was playing guitar, so they tried to play together, and I was fascinated. I don't know why. I mean, the spectacular thing is probably what got my attention first. That's what people remember of the banjo first. It's like so many notes all of a sudden just pops out of that instrument.
So I've had two other banjo players on this series, but they play clawhammer style, so quite different.
Yeah, totally different. I mean, many people ask me, "Oh, can you teach me clawhammer?" And I say, "Well, no, I'm sorry, I don't play." Very few banjo players play both styles. I know a few, but the technique is so different. It's even like counterproductive, I think, if you try to play both, because the movement is so different. When I play bluegrass, I want my thumb to be as free as possible and moving on all the strings as possible. When you play clawhammer, your thumb is stuck on the first string most of the time, and you want it to be there all the time. So you see, it's just like, but some guys achieve it. I mean, they can do it. But personally, I never tried it. I tried it once or twice and say, well, no, it's so opposite to my usual technique. I won't go deep into that.
You're about to hear Guy's composition, Chastou, from his album Paroles d'Arbre, with the Guy Donis Trio, with Marie-Soleil Bélanger on violin and Solon McDade on double bass.
Thank you.
I know we're going to have some excerpts from some of your albums, mm-hmm. but would you mind just doing a little demo and maybe showing a little bit?
Sure, sure. Let me first put on my picks, you know. So that's what you need when you play bluegrass. You're going to use three fingers, usually a plastic on your thumb and metal on the other two. Right? We play like, what is really typical of the bluegrass banjo is the rolling thing. You know, that's why we play so many notes, and we have like this continuous flow going all the time. You know, it's really like that. You know, it's really that technique. So it was like, if I speak about the different techniques, the first people that were playing the banjo in the bluegrass styles were mainly using the fact that the banjo is open, it's open tuned, which means I have a G chord without needing to use my left hand. So you can, of course, do something really easily just adding a few movements on your left hand. You know, I just hit one spot with my left hand. The rest is just like open strings. And it's based basically on arpeggios, which means I use mainly the notes that are in the chord. You know, it's just like G, B, D, and G again. Okay? And what is really special with that banjo is that you have that fifth string. Usually on a five-string banjo, you have a little key here to tune the fifth string. Mine is a bit special. I have all my five keys on the top because the fifth string goes into the neck here and goes out here in a kind of tunnel. But so sometimes people ask me, is it really a five string banjo? Yes, it is, but you just don't see the usual key here on the fifth string. So I have a shorter string here on my fifth string that is the other way around of what you would find normally on a string instrument, which means that you have like, if I go to bottom, fourth string, third, second, first, and my fifth string is my highest string, you know? So my higher string is close to my lower strings, which sounds totally weird, you know? There is like no logic in that. I always wonder, why do somebody add that string, you know? And I had first the banjo in hand, I had no idea what to do with that string. You know, lost in Belgium, wanting to learn the major. It was like, what am I going to do with that? But after a while, you realize how helpful it is for different reasons. So my fifth string is tuned in G, but in fact, as it's shorter, it makes the same note as my first string, you know? Which allowed me to make a lot of close notes really easily, you know, here. So it's just like this proximity of these notes on different strings allowed me to make melodies really quickly without having to. If I had to do that on a guitar, I would have to move my hand all over the neck. Here I just take one position and I'm able to do a lot of things within the same positioning because of that proximity of the notes. So I come back to my first bluegrass style, so working mainly with the arpeggios. And so I'm using like different rolls, like forward roll, we call that, thumb, index, middle. Backward roll, the other way around, middle, index, thumb, or alternate, thumb, index, thumb, middle. And it's basically these three movements that you move over different strings that like allow you to play like this style. And this style became famous in the late 1940s with a man named Earl Scruggs. And he became famous, you know, when you want instrumental music to become well known, there was like one way that is great is if it's become movie music, you know, if it's used in a movie or in a TV series, you know. And I mean, he has like one music that went famous because it was the music of a movie named Bonnie and Clyde. And that was the famous for banjo player at least, tune that named Foggy Mountain Breakdown. And it's really based on this arpeggio. Really based on that. Another tune went famous because it was the music of a popular TV series, which was the Beverly Hillbillies. And pretty famous in the 50s too. Etc. You know, so it's just like that's how the five-string banjo became really a leading instrument in the bluegrass music. It was like that, Mr. Earl Scruggs, that popularized that three-finger styles. I mean, he was not the inventor of it, but that's the guy that really like settled the technique, and really like he was incredible because. So it was in the late 40s, and the way he was playing at that time, still listening to it now, which is like 80 years, well, yeah, you know, like 70 years later, he's playing his top notch. He directly understood and directly played it at the best it could have been played. While normally when you develop a technique for an instrument, it takes a while, and the next guy takes it to another level. But his playing is still, if you listen to it now, is still at the same level as the top players now. It's still as powerful, it's still as fast, and still as clean, which is like amazing. I mean, wow, that guy got it like directly, you know, which is really impressive. Later in the process of the instrument, people have developed different way to use the instrument. You know, that just so instead of playing like just arpeggios, they managed to start to play scale on the instrument, okay? So that was called the melodic style, because that allows you to imitate and to reproduce what was really popular, which was the fiddle tunes that a lot of people were playing in the old time, and bluegrass music. And with the arpeggio style, you could kind of play around the melody, but not having it precisely like a fiddle player or a violin player or a mandolin player would play it. So that melodic style allow you to develop the playing to be like more closer to the real melody of the tune, instead of, you know, doing something around it with your arpeggios. And the third technique was like to, again, making, so the melodic style was using scales in a very special way, typical to the banjo, which is like, I play my first note, it's a G scale here that fits the instrument because I'm in open G. So I start my scale on my third string, and to play my next note, which is higher, I'm going to a lower strings. That's kind of a strange way that is typical to the banjo. So I'm playing my G here, I'm playing my A, my G on my third string, I'm playing my A on my fourth string. Then I'm going to my second string open B, and I'm going to my third string again to go to my higher next note. I'm going to a lower string. So, okay, now again my first string, second string, and I finish it with my fifth string. So you can play like almost after a while, you develop that and you use the open strings, which, you know, you can play like the most common scale you need. I mean, in bluegrass and old time music, it's based on, you know, pretty much the same kind of chords. So, you know, it's always in the key that is playable with a violin. So it means it's like in A, in D, or in G sometime, okay? So when you know these scales on the banjo, you actually can, you know, play these tunes pretty much. Now, there is way like, there are ways like to play in any keys if you want, but I won't like talk too much about it. It's really like for banjo geeks maybe. And now later, people have developed a way to play scales, which what we call single string. So it's, which is more closer to what a guitar player would do, which means we play several notes on the same string. Like if I play, you know, you see it looks even closer to what a guitar player would do, which means I place two notes on the same string and I go to the higher string to make the higher note. It's more logical to me. You know, it looks more logical than... So you have two ways to play these scales, the melodic style or the single string styles. And single string came pretty early in the process too. I mean, even in the 1940s, 50s, like at the same time as earthquakes, people was playing this style. But it wasn't until the famous banjo player named Bela Fleck came in and really like started to develop that single string thing up to an incredible level that like all the possibilities of the single string like came out. And so it allows you like to improvise just, you know, more closely to what a guitar player would do. And so he was able to play in any style of music because he could master the original style. I mean, the basic based on the arpeggios. He could master the melodic style. He could do like scaling. I mean, if I want to make a melodic scale in the E flat, I can do that. It's possible. You know, you just have to know your neck a little bit. So, and then you can do the same scale E flat, but melodic style in the single string side. So you have like plenty of possibilities, you know, to do things in the different styles. And also what is typical to this instrument and to, you know, like strings instruments in general, but with the banjo I think a little bit more, that you can find the same note in several different places. So if I want to play a D, I can play a D with my open first, or here, or here, or here. And so having these two elements, which I can play a lot of notes close to the same position, and I can find the same note on different place on the neck, it just like, it makes it really interesting, and it can be confusing at some time. Because I mean, okay, which is the best fingering to play the same note? I mean, if I play like a simple, for example, if I play like, or, you know, I play the same note here, and I have played it with three different fingerings, you know, while on a piano, if you want to play that note, there was one way to do it, not three ways, and I probably would have more if I was looking forward to it. Yeah. So it makes it like incredibly interesting, but can be confusing at one point.
So listening to your album, Ski, it seems like Bela Fleck was definitely an influence.
Well, of course, I mean, it's just like, how can you avoid it?
Yeah.
Obviously. I mean, he really made a revolution in the technique of the banjo. But what is even more important, that he made a kind of big step up with musically what you can do with the instrument, you know, mm-hmm. which is like even more important, because many players have great technique, but after all, it's just like, okay, how do you use it to make great music, you know? And that's what he made. I mean, it's comparable to Django Reinhardt made for the guitar, you know, it's really to that level. He took the guitar and all of a sudden, wow, you can do that on jazz with the guitar. Bela Fleck has done the same with the banjo. You can take the banjo and the banjo, because the banjo was not taken seriously as an instrument for a long, long time. In the early 20th century, banjo was highly popular. And there you had like banjo orchestra, and they were played in classical music, in ragtime music. And all of a sudden, it just disappeared. It was also an instrument that was used a lot in comedy things, you know, like white people, you know, colored their face in black and were playing banjo. It became like an instrument that nobody wanted to hear that much about.
It had like a racist connotation, so even though
exactly.
the banjo came
exactly.
from Africa originally.
Yeah, exactly. And so when earthquakes came in and made the banjo popular in bluegrass world, it was great because banjo became popular again, but it was in a very narrow musical community. You know, the bluegrass fans loved earthquakes. But I mean, when Bela Fleck came in and started playing with Chick Corea and Joshua Bell and, you know, all these incredible names in any kind of music, then all of a sudden the banjo was respected in any kind of music, which was like great for people like me. It means that you don't have to prove to people that, yes, banjo is worth listening to it, you know. Mm-hmm. So when you were making music, nobody, well, the people that knew a little bit about, wouldn't ask you, well, what do you play that silly instrument? Well, it's not a silly instrument, you know. It's just like, I mean, no music instrument is silly. It's just the way you use it that is silly or not. You know, it's the same with, like, sometimes I listen to some players that play, you know, I was one bother in my life with a djembe player that was playing near my house, and he was playing really badly. So I developed a really, like, kind of hate for the djembe. But when somebody is playing djembe very well, it's super nice. I mean, so it's no instrument is like a joke or is like... I was one invited... At a radio show at Radio Canada. They were making a special segment. I don't remember what show it was. And they were talking about instruments that were once not considered serious. So they made one show about the accordion, and then there was the banjo, and then there was, like, you know, a few others. And so, yeah, it's not... It all depends on the music you do. And so Bela Fleck is the guy that took the technique of the banjo to another level, but also took the banjo to another level of recognition amongst the music world in general. So mm-hmm. that's incredibly important.
I think Parole d'Arbre, speech of the trees, I guess we translate it that way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, tree talking, maybe, I don't know.
Tree talking, yeah. So the title track... Actually, are you playing dobro on that?
No, I'm not playing dobro on that. It's Joe Grass that is playing dobro on that,
okay.
on that particular track. Yeah, I played a few tracks on dobro here and there, but when I need it on that track, he's playing the lead melody and he's making a solo. So I had to ask somebody that is like a really serious dobro player, which I'm not.
Okay. So do you want to speak to that album? Or?
That album is just like, it's. I already had... A project that was a bit similar when I was in Europe, that I called Badian at that time. So it was a bit the same instrumentation, which is like double bass, violin, percussion, and the banjo. So that was my first try to get out of bluegrass, you know. And it's as my musical roots are really different from somebody that is from like Kentucky or Texas, or, you know, it's just like, oh, I always felt that I had to do something that was coming from my background, musical background. And so that's the first band I started playing my own composition and alongside the other band members. And so that Parole d'Arbre album is a bit like the following of that project. I took the same instrumentation again. And so I composed the whole album with that. And what was nice at that time that I was lucky enough to have a grant to write the album and then to record the album, which is one of the only time in my life I had that. So all of a sudden I have plenty of time to just focus on writing and arranging, you know, which was like really great in my life. So I'm really happy with that. With that album, it's probably the album that, you know, if somebody asked me which album of you should I listen to if there was like one album, and I would say that that's probably the one, you know, even if it was recorded like kind of 15 years ago now or even more. But I still think that just because I had that amount of time to just like think about nothing else but, you know, preparing that album, I think it's good. And now the only thing with this music is that, like, people ask me, okay, what kind of music do you compose? And I'm like, well, you know, it's you have the banjo, so it's related to bluegrass, but it's related also to my classical training that I had in my youth on the piano, and then you have that jazz element because of my father that was listening and playing jazz, and then I have this, you know, all this folk music. I'm, you know, I'm in Quebec here, and I try to play the Quebec traditional music as well. And so it's all these elements mixed together. And even, I mean, you can find, if you listen to it and you know a little bit, I mean, when I was a teenager, I was listening to mainstream music, to whatever rock, pop was, music was. And you can hear these elements too in that. So it's a bit of mix of everything. It's just like what pops out at the moment. Mm-hmm. But I really try to make something that is like, that doesn't sound weird also. I want it to be like easy listening music. Even sometimes if it's like complicated stuff because of that banjo thing. But I mean, I want it to be like easy to listen to. You know, when you tell people, well, it's a mix of classical and bluegrass and jazz, and people could tell, oh my God, what is that strange thing? I don't think it sounds strange in any way. It's just like what comes out of my mind and my fingers at one point. Mm-hmm.
This next musical selection is the title track from Paroles d'Arbre with the Guy Denis Trio.
Thank you.
Well, it's a beautiful album. And also the second one you did with that group, Roots, Risks, and Reveries.
Yeah.
I really like that tune, Grenouillage.
Okay, yeah. Uh-huh.
Which I guess we translate as frog-like. I don't know what you meant by that.
Yeah, it was like, you know, I have a little cottage in the middle of the woods somewhere, and every spring you have like these like frogs coming alive and making like huge noise, you know. And so that tune just came from that period, and so I was trying to find some songs. Yeah, Grenouillage is a bit like, I will just show you if you want. It's a bit close to at first to a guitar player technique, which is like you're just playing the bass string with your thumb like this, which we don't do often with the banjo. As I show you, it's more like, you know, the thumb can play any string at any point, but the guitar players play finger picking, mostly gonna play, alternate the thumb on the bass string and playing the melody with the other two. So that's a bit the idea of that too. Go too far because we're gonna listen to the real tune. So that was the idea of that tune. It's just like, oh, give it a different bounce and you see a little bit of that, of the guitar technique on that. And also, well, and also, I mean, I had that bass and violin player on that, and so I always liked having strings like that arrangement of my tunes for some reason. Yeah, that's the one I'm really happy with. I mean, that tune is just like, well, that's a nice tune to listen to, and sometimes you make things that are really like complicated, and sometimes the best tunes are the ones that are not that difficult. And this one is a good example. You know, I mean, to play on the banjo is probably one of the easy tune on the CD, but after several years that I have recorded, I can say, well, that's one very good tune, you know. So sometimes you try too hard, you want to, you know, make something impressive, and sometimes when you just cool down a little bit, that makes things more interesting.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Thanks. So it's with Marie Soleil Bélanger, and mm-hmm. is it Solon McDade? How does he pronounce McDade. His name?
Solon McDade, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Now you will hear Grenouillage from the Guy Denis Trio's album Roots, Risks, and Reveries. Now, let's go back to your youth. I'm curious. So you mentioned you were taking classical piano.
Yeah.
How did the banjo really come into your life? Like, you heard the banjo that one time.
Mm-hmm.
How old were you then?
I was around 17. So I took like a classical piano when I, from probably 7, 8 years old until my teenage years came in, and then I didn't want to, you know, play piano anymore. I think it was not that cool, you know? And so that's something I regret deeply. I mean, I should have gone further. But, and then I was like fooling around with the instrument, you know, in the house. As I told my father was playing guitar, and my mother was playing classical piano, and my father could play a bit of jazz piano too. So I had all these instruments. I was fooling around on the piano still, but more on bit of jazzy stuff. And at one point I asked to have a string instrument for myself, and I bought a little, and they bought me a little mandolin. That was my first personal instrument. It was a small mandolin. And I was playing it, but I was not that passionate about it. You know, I just fool around, but never really dig it. And so when we were at that place that I was talking sooner, and I watched that banjo player, and I really like stayed the whole evening just watching him. And a few, I don't remember precisely, but weeks or months later, my father bought a 5-string banjo, and he pretended that it was because he always wanted one. But my guess is probably he saw my interest. And when I put my hand on that, it just never stopped. I mean, that was definitely my instrument. And I'm still playing some mandolin. I'm playing guitar. You know, I used to play a little bit of dobro, but I mean, banjo was always my main thing. The other one I played because trying to be a professional musician, you have to try to spread your possibilities a little bit, because I mean, obviously in Quebec, I mean, being a professional banjo player is kind of a myth. But I mean, banjo was always my focus, and even like I'm playing the banjo for more than 40 some years now, and I'm still taking it every day and enjoy it and finding new stuffs every day. So it's still a work in progress, even after all these years, which is amazing, mm-hmm. which is like truly amazing. And what is amazing too, that I mean, when I took the banjo, when I first started playing the banjo, I started a few years after Bill Fleck did. And so the way the banjo was played when I started playing it and the way it's played now is a totally different thing. So all through my career, I had to just like, oh, that's a new way to do things. Let's work on that. Always, always. It's not like, I mean, you are a violin player, and I guess when you learn classical violin player, the technique is pretty much set up. That's the way you do it, and it probably won't change much during your life. While the banjo, at the stage when I started playing and where it is now, the technique has changed a lot. So I had to adapt myself, you know, and to try to keep up with all these guys that were coming in, like Bela Fleck and some others, you know, just because I wasn't trusted it. It was not like a competition. I didn't want to be like, but I was so interested and fascinated by all the aspects of the instrument that I always wanted to, okay, how do these guys do that? I wanted to know how, you know. So it was like, it's still a work in progress. It sounds crazy after all these years, but I, you know, it's that's what's make it like really interesting. I'm still like passionate about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hi, just a short break from the episode, which I hope you're enjoying so far. If you want to check out over 100 episodes you may have missed, in addition to your podcast player or YouTube, I have an extensive website, leahroseman.com, with show notes, transcripts, the complete catalog of episodes, and you can sign up there for my weekly newsletter to get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests. Please do share your favorite episodes with your friends, follow me on social media, and share my posts. And if you can spare a few dollars to help support the series, that would be amazing, and you can find that link in the show notes. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. Now back to the episode. I mean, I've played violin for almost 50 years, but it's still very much a work in progress. And I used to think if I got, you know, once I was a professional, I would have this time to like learn other instruments, or I'd have that motivation. But it's still all about the violin.
Yeah. It's what is nice that when I take another instrument, it's, you know, the first steps you take on a new instrument, you're making like huge progress. So it's like, you know, it's great. It's just like, oh, I'm getting better, really. While on the banjo, if I want to get, you know, a little bit better, it takes a lot of work. So you know, it's like sometimes it's good to, you know, if I decide to work on a piece on a mandolin, and then I can, after a few minutes, I can play it just like, oh, wow, that's cool. You know, on the banjo, if I want to learn something new, it's a challenge, you know, but that's what makes it interesting too.
So, speaking of mandolin, were you influenced by Sam Bush?
Well, yeah, I was influenced by Sam Bush, and well, I'm you know, the mandolin, I never went deep in the mandolin like I went with the banjo. So I played pretty much what came out naturally with me on the mandolin. I never studied precisely one player or another. It just like what my instinct tell me to do. But Sam Bush was a really important person musically. I mean, when I was first started playing the banjo, I mainly listened to what was called at that time newgrass music, which is like bluegrass music, but a bit with a more like rock and roll attitude, which is like mixing like really like high power tune and you know, having that kind of less stiffy attitude that most bluegrass bands had in the early days. And so there was a band named Newgrass Revival, and you have two eras of that band. The first was, but Sam Bush was part of both. And Bela Fleck came in that band in the second era of that band. It was the first big, important band where people discovered Bela Fleck, you know. So it was like, but I mean, the heart of the band and the soul of the band was really Sam Bush all the way. And so he was more important as a musician than as a mandolin player, because I never was studying mandolin that hard, you know, but I was listening to that band like it was like probably my main influence when I was starting playing the banjo, which was in the late 70s, early 80s. It was like that was like the thing that really like, wow, I love that kind of bluegrass technique, a bluegrass root, but was that a more like, oh, go for it, you know, let's rock it, you know, kind of energy that Sam Bush was bringing.
Mm-hmm. Now, in Belgium, did you have mentors? Did you have teachers? Were you?
I have teachers. I would say it's people showed me some stuff, you know, but I learned. So I, you know, people showed me the few roles. So finally, I was able to understand what my fifth string is supposed to do, and so it was helpful, obviously. I wouldn't call them mentor, you know, because I was way ahead of them technically, because I was so fascinated and I was working so hard on the instrument. So I learned a lot by myself, which was kind of an adventure, because at that time you have like no internet, so no YouTube, no nothing. So to find informations about bluegrass banjo playing in Belgium was kind of a struggle, you know. I remember like recording vinyl on tapes and then playing, you know, a five-second sequence on a tape, trying to understand what the guy was doing and trying to reproduce it. But luckily, at that time, there was an important banjo player named Bill Keith that was living in France, and he was the main guy that developed the melodic style that we talked about sooner. And he was living in France, and he put out a few books about the banjo and melodic style at that time. So I was lucky to find a few and to learn his playing like upside and down, you know, really, really, I went deep in that. So that was a great a great help. But I mean, after that, it was mostly like listening to. I remember at one point, there was a company that made like tapes series of teaching. So I had one with Bela Fleck. You know, you had like six tapes with all the book with that, and you can really go deep in his style. And I had another one made by another very important banjo player named Tony Trischka, which was Bela Fleck's mentor. And then Bill Keys, the guy that has developed the melodic style we spoke about. So, I mean, these three guys were really by far my main influences, you know. And so I wouldn't call them mentor because we, you know, I met them, but I never learned, you know, with them because we were on different continents. So, yeah, and when I put on my first band, I was obviously the only one that had an idea of what bluegrass music was. So I had to find a way that I was already the one that knew a little bit about it, even if I didn't know that much. So it was a kind of bluegrass band. That's why when I started to record my own music, all of a sudden I was playing with jazz musician and classical musician. And these guys helped me so much because they knew so many things that I didn't knew, you know, harmonically speaking, how to make an arrangement, how to, you know, it really like brought me to another level of understanding music. It was not in bluegrass, but just my understanding of music was really helped by these people. So, I mean, these people were, I had like some mentors that were not banjo players, but people that were playing with, that agreed with playing with me, even if I was exploring and not really knowing where I was going to precisely. And when I came in Canada, I finally found some people that were really bluegrass musician, and I realized how different it is. So I had to go back to my bluegrass playing to be able to really be there, you know, because my playing was good already, but I mean, to really understand the music and play it like the way it should be played, that's where I came in, that I really got it, I finally.
So you immigrated with your wife,
and yeah.
Why did you guys decide to come to Canada?
Oh, well, that's a story, you know. I mean, Belgium is a really strange place. It's a place that is good if you want to have a regular life and a regular job and don't, you know, that's it. I mean, if you want to work for the government, or if you want to work in a bank, or if you want to have like, you know, but for somebody like me that wanted like to focus my life on music, it was not a comfortable place. I mean, it was a mess. I mean, not that I couldn't find a way to play music, but it was like, okay, you're not a usual working 9-to-5 guys, and all the administration, Belgium is a kind of an administration nightmare. Because you have like the federal state that is divided in two community, and then divided in two, in provinces, and et cetera. And the fact that you have the French community and the Flemish community that speak Dutch, and there was like, they just can't work together. You know, it's just like, if somebody proposed something, the other one was rejected automatically. And so everything is complicated in Belgium because as they don't agree on anything, they have to make like compromise on everything. I mean, the name of the, just to give a strange example, you know, the name of the soccer team in Belgium, what's written on their shirt is not Belgique or Belgie, which would be the name of the country in our national languages. It's written now Belgium in English, because no one would say, oh, you can put your, yeah, let's call it Belgique. It's okay, you know, no. They just couldn't agree, so they decided, okay, let's write it in English, so nobody's going to argue that we used the national language over the other national language, you know. So that everything is complicated in Belgium that way, and I just couldn't stand it at one point. I was like, okay, guys, just like get along with it, you know. And it would seem normal for a banjo player to feel weird in a country like this, but my wife had the same situation. She was stuck in a job and couldn't go elsewhere, because when you get a job in Belgium, you stay there, you don't move, you know. And that's not what we wanted in our life. So at one point we decided, okay, that's enough, let's go somewhere else. I mean, both my brothers, they started to work for a company when they were 20 years old, and they worked for the same place until their last working day, you know. And here in North America, it's not usual, you know. Most people, they change over, you know, they like to change. It's when you meet an employer, it's actually a good thing if you have like different experiences. I mean, Belgium is the other way around. If you want to change, are you like somebody that makes a mess when you work somewhere, or I mean, you know, you have instability issues, or so. Well, it's that's there, and I mean, it was a great experience. I mean, I never looked back. I mean, I never once in my life thought, oh, maybe I should have stayed, or maybe I should go back. Whoa, no way. It's kind of, it's really a freedom that I have here that I didn't have there. That's really the final point. It's a kind of freedom, you know. It's just like Belgium and Europe and a lot of countries in Europe are so like tight in one way to see things, that when you try to make your own things a little bit out of what's usual, it makes things like complicated. So I don't want my life to be complicated. My professional life is weird enough, so I don't want things around to be complicated.
Yeah, before we started recording today, I had asked you if you knew Flemish. I was curious about that, because Belgium is a very small country, and you said you had to choose between Flemish and English. So I guess you made the wiser choice. But it is surprising to me that most Belgians don't know a bit of both.
Well, again, it's that kind of like antagonism, is it the right word, between the two communities. I mean, I am a Flemish, I won't bother learning your language. And the French are a bit, I'm Belgium, won't bother. And, you know, I had like some really good friends that were Flemish, really good friends. So it's, most people don't really bother about that. But against a minority of like, you know, extremists or whatever you call them, are making this thing big all the time. And that means that politically it's always like, you know, a nightmare. I mean, when Belgium once was not able to put on a government for a year and a half, you know, the country was without government for a year and a half because they couldn't settle together to do
it. So they couldn't make a coalition because they have smaller
political
parties?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
Interesting. So. We were just talking before about Tony Trischka. So you actually worked with him a little bit? You met him a few times?
Actually, I have a little story with Tony Trischka. I mean, in my first band in Europe a long, long time ago, we decided to make a recording. And we asked Tony Trischka to come in Belgium and produce it. And he came.
Oh.
And so it was fantastic for me to meet such a high-end banjo player. And such a nice person as well. And so we spent the time of the recording in Belgium together, and we felt good together, you know. And then I went to New York to spend a few days with him. I told you sooner that I don't really have a mentor. But I mean, if there was like one important banjo player that I actually met and learned a lot from him, just watching him closely, it is Tony Trischka. And he was, when I started playing, he was the big guy, and he was the guy pushing the boundaries on the instrument. And then he had a student named Belefleck that came in and just like, wow, take over everything, you know. And when I went to spend a few days with Tony Trischka, he's still living in New York, and the first night I came and he said, okay, come with me, we go see a show. and it was Newgrass Revival with Bela Fleck playing the banjo. And it was all of a sudden, I was just coming out of Belgium from nowhere, obviously, speaking of bluegrass, and I was sitting at a table with all these big musicians because Tony knew them all. So I was there. But what am I supposed to say to these guys? Just like, what? You know, I have no idea. I just shake hands with Bela Fleck. Hi, Bela, this is my friend Guy from Belgium. He's banjo player too. And I say, hello. I was still very young at the time. I was like 20. Well, I don't know exactly. My late 20s probably. So I was like super shy. What am I supposed to say to these guys? But so, yeah, I had the chance to meet these big people and see what their life is. And the thing I didn't want to do was just like to try to push and keep, you know, being friends with these guys. I want to be friends with these guys, absolutely, because I know what their life is. And they're meeting people like me every day, you know. So you don't want to bother them, you know. If it happens, it happens. But I don't want to guy sending emails every 2 days and then calling them and say, hey. No, I don't feel comfortable with that. There was one thing in my life that I don't want to do is bothering people. This is something I'm really scared of.
Well, it is a problem. You know, the majority of musicians are freelancers and have to have these business skills that we mostly aren't taught and doesn't come naturally to most artists.
Yeah, right? Yeah, I'm a disaster at that, obviously. As I was always, most of the time, the leader of the band I was putting on, I had to do the business side as well, because nobody would do it. And so I did a bit of it. But I mean, just to give a simple example, I mean, you know, nowadays it's easy. You can send emails to a group of organizers, you know. But after that, you have to follow up. That's, yeah. I don't. Because I'm if I have to call somebody and say, hey, did you listen to my demo? Did you watch my video? I feel like I'm bothering people. And as I told, I hate that. So I don't do it. And so whoever wants to hire me, yeah, hire me. But I won't call you 15 times in a row. Unfortunately, that's the way things work. I mean, now to be a successful musician, you have to be a good musician, but you have to be a good entrepreneur as well, or to have a good team around you that takes care of it. But I mean, very, very few person manage to have that outside of the show business world. I mean, obviously, I am not part of the show business at all. I'm so, you know, underground that no one's gonna say, oh, I'm gonna make business with that guy. I'm gonna make a lot of money out of him, you know. Well, no, you won't, probably.
So watching Tony Trischka, what kind of insights did you get when you're able to see him in person?
I mean, there was a kind of power in his playing and a power in his focus. I think that, you know, people ask me, what makes a difference between high-end musicians? And I say, it's the brain. It's totally the brain. I mean, you can have like some physical abilities, you know, that can be put you a little bit, like, give you a little advantage. But I mean, the brain is all there is. I mean, and so the brain you start with, but also the way you train your brain later. And so I'm focusing on that a lot when I'm teaching now, because I realized that, I say that earlier, I realized that really late in my process. And so I had to work hard on that, to force my brain to control what I was doing and knowing what I was doing. And so that was amazing. I mean, you watch these guys and the power of their concentration is amazing. I mean, how can watching Bela Fleck playing like Rhapsody in Blue on a banjo? Wow. It's just like, because that's not an instrument where the fingerings are natural. I mean, when you're playing Jean-Sébastien Bach on a violin, I guess the fingerings, the tune was written for violin, so it's logical, you know? So it's easier to remember because you have the melody, and the melody feels natural. When you have to play Jean-Sébastien Bach on a banjo, the fingerings are not natural at all. So it takes like a lot of mind power to be able to do that, you know. And so I'm always like really impressed with that. I think that's what makes a difference between these guys and the others.
So should we talk about the Montreal Bluegrass League?
Yeah. So the Montreal Bluegrass League, you know, I for many years my main act in the bluegrass was a band named Notre Dame de Grasse. And so we toured, in pretty much all over Canada. But I never have made in my life a bluegrass album under my name. I have made several with bands, but never one under my name. So that was the first idea. Finally, maybe I should do one. And the second idea was I wanted like to gather all the people that I had a chance to work with in Montreal since the year I was there. And it was at the beginning of the pandemic too. So, and at that time I was thinking, oh, maybe I should do a series of videos with my friends, you know, put that on YouTube just to have fun and show people what we can do together. And then the pandemic came in and the whole planet were making videos. And so I decided, okay, no, that's not a good moment to do that. And so I started recording tracks of the tune that I thought would be a video at first. And I did that by myself. You know, I was going to my little cottage with my gear and started recording things, making like pretty much a pre-prod. And after a while, I listened back to it and I say, well, that sounds good, you know? And so I went further on that. So I prepared all 14 tracks. And I asked the 14 people that I have in mind as a guest, would you be part of it? And all 14 people accepted, which was like, wow, thank you very much. And the second great thing was that when they came in my studio, kind of, you know, mostly for the singer, I have imagined what could be good for them and what key they could sing in, etc., because I know them quite well, but it was still risky, you know. But they came in and recorded, and I'm so pleased with the results. I mean, and I really decided on that album that I would make only covers, which means for this is the first album in my life that has like no composition on it. I decided no, it's just like it's gonna be like all covers, just because when I was playing around, I'm playing in several different bluegrass situations, and I didn't have any bluegrass CDs to sell, and most people don't know nothing about that music here around or don't know a lot. So I said no, I want to show people what bluegrass is. So I really decided it's gonna be like all covers from all bluegrass, you know, person from different areas. So it was like from the early days until like some more progressive things. And so that was the idea. And it kept me busy during the pandemic, which was a pretty good thing for musicians, as you know. And so it came out really well. And so now the Montreal Bluegrass League ID started with that album. And then it became a band, and then now it became a monthly event. So in Montreal, I have once a month and invite a musician or two to play with me. And then we have an evening with that is split it in a performance. And then after that, I invite anybody that wants to jam with us to jam with us. And I really like make it for any level players, you know, just the guitar player that can strum a few chords, come along, we'll integrate you. Or, you know, because I did that because many of my students are totally petrified when they have to play for people. And so I want them to introduce them to playing with other people in a non-stressful situation. So when they sit down with like 15 or 20 other musicians playing around, it's not, the focus is not on them, you know. So it's a good tool for them to just, you know, get used to playing with people. I was listening the other day to a Bela Fleck interview, And he said, the first thing I learned on the banjo was the role I showed you, you know. And so I learned that role, and I learned like two chords on the left hand. And so I was able, so he went to folk jams or bluegrass jam, and he was sitting in the back and just practicing his role with changing the chords to play along. That's how it started. So that's where everybody is starting, you know. And so I really encourage people to just, oh yeah, you're not, we won't play fast, we won't play flashy stuff during the jam. It's just for everybody to feel able to play with other people. So the Bluegrass League is like a kind of concept now, if I can say. It was for the album, then a band that I play live with, and then the monthly event that is like a performance and jam thing. So it became like pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. Finally.
And I guess it's also what you would have liked to have had when you were coming up in Belgium.
My God, yes. Yeah. Yes, please. I mean, I missed that, because that probably was a struggle in my development, which was like I couldn't find anybody to play with. And the musician that I was playing with, I was the one that was teaching them how to do things, you know, but mm-hmm. nobody never took me, you know. It's as a musician, you get better when you play with better musician than you are.
Yeah.
Okay. And so at first in Belgium, it was tough for me, you know, to find these, because nobody was as passionate as I was. You know, it's never a matter of I was more gifted. It's just that I was so interested and so willing to be good at that very quickly I was, you know, a step up of everybody else around me. And so if I had been at that time surrounded with people with the same level of energy, you know, in the way we want to be good, it probably would be really helpful, you know. And mm-hmm. that's probably why I reached my peak, I think, pretty late in my development, you know, musically speaking. I was always able to play fast is, you know, no problem with that, but I mean really being able to control what I was doing and to really like be aware of what I was doing precisely, that came pretty late in my development, because nobody told me, hey man, you should like, you know, be a little bit more aware of what you're doing. Usually I was just reproducing what I have learned, you know, just by, you know, repeating it over and over and over again. I was able to do it, but never was really understanding what was going on, really. It was way later in my development that I decided, okay, now I should, you know, understand a little bit more how this instrument works, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so that was tough in Belgium to be a bluegrass banjo, just because you don't have that emulation. Is it the right word? Just mm-hmm. people to push you to go to get better, you know, the right thing. But I had that. And, you know, I had that in when I was playing more jazzy stuff, so more, you know, in my own material, because I could play with jazz musician and classical musician that has like so much knowledge that I didn't have. But with the bluegrass sides, again, it was really when I came here that I met like some people that know exactly how you should play that music.
And have you spent time like in the summers down in Virginia or Kentucky?
Not much, actually. Obviously, first thing is just like the summer, there was like two situations. Or I'm touring and I'm busy, or I'm not touring and I'm broke. So I can't allow myself to go all to these old festivals and take a plane and just, well, no, I just can't, you know. And that's something I wish I could do. I mean, just go there and jam with as many people as I can. And I mean, and also playing in the States when you're a Canadian, officially, I mean, if I wanted to book dates, it's complicated.
Yeah.
I mean, just like it's really an issue. So I never bother to try to. I mean, I'm still so passionate about the instrument, but I'm like not a businessman at all. I'm not an entrepreneur at all. I that side is missing in my career, actually. I know that. That's the way I am. I try to, you know, but when you try to do something that you're not interested in, you're not good at it. And that's where my business side is. I mean, I don't like to do it, so I'm not good at doing it. I try to, you know, sometimes I send a mail, hey, would you hire my band? But that's about everything I do. I will not call back and say, hey, did you listen to it? Because no, I just can't, you know? And I mean, and obviously, who in the business who would say, hey, you're a banjo player, I'm going to take care of your career. Well, you know, it's not like the flashiest thing in the world if you want to be an agent or whatever. So I managed to make regular gigs. I have students always. So, I mean, my career, it's at the point when I'm happy with it. I mean, I'm not like, you know, sometimes I see those musicians, like highly successful musician. But I mean, they are all over the place all the time. I mean, they have quite a frantic life, yeah. You know? And I don't know if I want this. I mean, I probably would have enjoyed it at one point if I could have it. But now I like to... The luxury I have in my life is time, you know? Mm. That's the only luxury I have in life, but I think it's a big one. And so I never... I make a lot of compromise in my life because of my musician career. But on that, I never make compromise, which means I won't sacrifice everything to music. You know, because I like to go to my cottage, just relax and read books and not being obsessed with my next gigs or my next recording. I think it's a luxury that I have. It's just like, I mean, when you read interviews about all these big guys like Bill O'Fleck, I mean, these people are so intense. I mean, they just finish a gig and then they go in the hotel practicing for the next project. At like, you know, wow. That's something that I can't do. I mean, it's just like after a game, I'm just like, I just want to relax and have a beer with a friend and just, you know. And so you see how, I mean, that's why these people finally achieve to be like such incredible musician. And I mean, Bill O'Fleck was talking about his collaboration with Chick Corea. Mm-hmm. And that's how I realized how intense this guy. I mean, they had recorded something in a studio, and as soon as Chick Corea came out of the cabin, he was already looking at charts for his next project. You know, and he's, wow, that's intense. I mean, I'm not like that. You know? And I'm more passionate, and I'm probably practicing more than many musicians. But compared to these guys, no, I'm not there, obviously.
So you're teaching, you teach different instruments, different levels, group, private, and online.
I'm mainly teaching banjo, actually. Okay. When I have a request, I can teach mandolin, and I even teach guitar to one person that asked me to. So banjo is the only instrument that I can say, I know it. I know how it works. I know how to teach you and how I can make things work for you. You know, on mandolin I can show you some things, but I'm clear with people. I mean, you'd rather I can show you stuff, so I know the basics, technique things, but obviously I won't bring you to a high level, you know. So it's banjo is really the main thing on my teaching, because that's what I feel comfortable to do. Because I mean, sometimes I see people pretending to be teachers and I'm just like, whoa, you should not, you know, and I don't want to be one of these people.
Do you use tablature with most of your students?
Oh, that's a good question, actually. When I started teaching, I was using tons of tablatures because that's the way I learned a lot when I found these things in Europe. And I realized that many people, if they just learn through tablature, they're stuck with it and they don't really understand what they're doing. So I have a tendency to use tablature less and less. as a teaching process now. So I'm mainly showing the tune to the people just by ear. Mm-hmm. And I'm then, when they have it, I give them the tablature as a reminder. If they can't find the tune anymore, if they have a, how was I supposed to play that? That's what I do. Because if you're stuck, I have so many students over the years. Some of them were learning on tablature, were doing really well. But many, many of them, they were learning by tablature, were not really understanding what they were doing. And we're just reproducing numbers on a page rather than reproducing the melody they have in their head, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. Adam Hurt, the clawhammer player I interviewed last year, he said the same thing. And he doesn't like using tablature himself, but he'll give it to people at the end of the workshop, at the end of the lesson.
Yeah, yeah. I use tablature a lot. I mean, I'm comfortable with it because the what is written down on the paper make sense musically to me now. You know, so it's that way it's good. I mean, Bela Fleck used tablature all the time. I mean, he just transcribed the Rhapsody in Blue from Gershwin for his next album. And he can't read music fluently. So he always transfer everything in tablature for the banjo and he can read it really fast and really well. And the same thing when he made his classical album like some times ago. He just transcribe everything in tablature because he can't read, as you know, just as classical musician can do. So from my early classical training days when I was you, I can read music, but I'm not any close as good as real classical music musicians are. But yeah, I can read, you know, if I have the musical score of a traditional tune, I can read it right there because it's in G or D or A and it's okay. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I certainly couldn't play a Bach partita reading it because that's too complicated. You know, I had to stop on it. I had like one time I was asked to record some Bach on the banjo for a short film. And wow, I had to transcribe it to tablature and to work hard to be able to do that. You know, I couldn't read it and transfer it to the instrument right away like you are able because you have the training for it. I don't have that training anymore for it.
So you talked about your phantom, your tunneled string before. When you bought this banjo, did you sell your old one? What kind of collection do you have for instruments?
Okay, yeah, I'm probably one of the only banjo player where I mean on earth that have only one banjo because I mean this is a kind of pricey instruments. I mean not in the same league as the violin or probably, but still, you know. So and when I feel comfortable on one specific instrument, I don't feel comfortable on another one. Mm-hmm. So I don't see the point to buy another instrument that I will never play because I won't feel as comfortable as I am on mine. Now, the story of this banjo is that a friend of mine that is a banjo player and that always had several high-hand banjo players at home because he likes it, one time gave me a call and said, "Wow, I have a new banjo. You should come in and try it. I thought you might enjoy it." And I went there and I loved it really, really. And it is this banjo. And at that time, the guy told me, well, I you know, he looked at me and he saw how much I was fond of this banjo. But he said, well, I won't sell it. You know, I just bought it. I want to use that banjo. Okay. But I went and I bought a similar one, you know, the one that I could find in a shop in Toronto, which is the 12th fret. About the only shop in Canada when you can find high-end banjo. And so I bought a similar banjo, but it was a different wood and it was a different tone ring. The tone ring is the middle part that you can see here, okay? And so, and I was happy with it. It was good, you know, I loved it. It was the same kind of wider neck, you know, with a radius, which is not usual for banjo. Usually most typical banjo is a flat, you know, fingerboard. This one is a radius fingerboard, which most modern banjo players use, like Bela Fleck and all these guys. And story and a bit of journey. And so I always had in mind that when I tried this banjo, it actually sounded a bit better than the one I bought for some reason. And so a few years later, the guy called me and said, oh, finally, I never get used to that banjo, I'm going to sell it. And so I bought it and sold my other. So the brand of the banjo is a Negville banjo. Mm-hmm. And so it's a brand that makes only banjos. And they really changed the whole way the instrument is built. Usually, when you see this part, what we call the pot of the banjo, the way to tighten the skin is always hooks and nuts here around, you know. While this banjo, it's a whole piece. And you tighten it with a kind of system that makes the two big metal parts to be stuck together. And so you can tighten your skin by just moving one part over another. And so it makes the banjo like really different. It's so easier to set it up. You know, when you had to tighten the skin with the other banjo, you have to go to one individual hooks after another, which this one, you just, if I remove the resonator, the back part here, it's easily to remove. You can go and decide with a special key and you just tweak your skin in seconds, you know, which is helpful. And also it changed the sounds of it because it's all in one piece instead of having like 80 different like metal parts that you have to adjust to have the right sound. If it's just one body thing. So it makes things like easier to, for example, if I had to change the skin, what I have to do because it become pretty old, you can see it's all worn out here. It takes like minutes, while in another banjo, it would take like hours. Mm-hmm. So all these things are interested. And then the tunnel here with the fifth string, it's an old idea that they like reactualize, you know, but it was not their original. It came for a banjo that was named Zither banjo, that was made in England in probably 19th century or early 20th century. But this is an old idea, and it's good because, I mean, when you move, sorry about that, when you move over the neck, when you have a key here, a tuner here, it's in your way.
Yeah.
Now with this system, it's not. So it makes, now, I mean, it's, the. But I mean, the main difference is really that body design, the neck that is like a bit wider than usual and with the radius. I mean, the fifth string tunnel is a bit more of a gadget. I mean, obviously it's great, but that's not what make me buy this banjo. It's really the playability and the sound. It has like a deeper sound that most banjo have. I mean, banjo has a tendency to be like a little bit aggressive. This one is really like a fuller sound. And again, you know, people like Bela Fleck or another name, Noam Pikelny, that have the big, big name now, they have a tendency to want a banjo that is less bright than, you know, in the early days of bluegrass.
So from the latest album, is there a tune you'd like to share? I was thinking also you had that promo video with the guys.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a tune that I thought would be good for a promotion tool. So, and again, it was during the pandemic. So I spent some time putting on a video that was a bit more than four people playing the music, you know, and this is the first time in my life I've done that. So I went around Montreal, it was during the winter, and I shoot a little, you know, view from there and tried to mix it with the tune. And the name of the tune was One Way Track, which makes sense with, you know, roads or railways or whatever view you could find about that. So yeah, I had fun with that and it looks like people enjoyed it. You know, more than just four people playing their instruments, which is like what I do usually because that's what happens, you know. So yeah, that's a good tune. It's a nice tune and it's like powerful. I mean, you have like a few ballads on that album, but obviously when you want to make a promotion, you want to have like a powerful tune to promote it.
This final tune is One Way Track from the Montreal Bluegrass League's recent album with Guy Donis on banjo, Joémie Verdon on double bass and voice, Léandre Joly-Pelletier on guitar and voice, and Tommy Gauthier on mandolin. For those of you listening on the podcast, I'll link the video to the show notes.
It's neat with the scenes of the driving in winter. So for the people, most people listen to this podcast audio only, but for those who are watching the video, could we share that video as part of it?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure, yeah.
Were the winters a shock for you, though, when you first immigrated?
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. No, really, it's weird because most Quebecers are moaning about the winter, and I like it a lot. As I'm originally from Belgium, we have a weather system that is pretty close to, you know, Great Britain or Ireland, which is like it rains a lot, and you have like a lot, many cloudy days. So when I came here, and you have like that, so you have like two different life. You know, you have the summer and you have the winter, and it's two complete different things. The nature changed totally. I mean, you have such a separation between two. While in Belgium, you can have the same temperature in December and in July sometime. You know, here, no, you really have a clear season difference. And I really enjoyed it. I mean, I love the summer, but I love the winter as well. I mean, the winter means no bugs. I mean, you can wander around on your racket, and I love it so much. And you can, and you have like no allergy problem, which I have sometime in the summer. So I feel, I have some people that I know that has like, they immigrate to the south and say, oh man, you should come over here. That's so nice. And I say, okay, what is the temperature today? And they, well, it's 38. I say, whoa, no, thank you very much. I prefer the winter. I never suffer from the cold. You know, if you adapt yourself, it's cool. While I suffer sometimes from heat, so I'd rather be in a country where, like this.
Yeah, I agree. So to close this out, Guy, I thought it might be interesting for you to reflect. you know, you were self-taught, self-motivated, and growing mm-hmm. up in a time, as you said, where we didn't have the internet, we didn't have all these sources of information, but we didn't have the distractions as well, you know?
That's an excellent point. That's an excellent point. And even for myself, sometimes I find today that just like, oh, please, I mean, shut your art computer and practice. What are you doing, you know? And so if it's an issue for me that is born without all these things, I mean, can you imagine for a 15 years old kid how tough it is to decide, now I'm going to leave TikTok and I'm going to put my hands on an instrument? It's you have to be like, to have a powerful mind to do that, seriously. So you're right. I mean, I had some difficulties because I was missing these tools that we have now, but at the same time, I have an amount of time, you know, and that most young people don't have, because they have so much pressure to be on this screen all the time. That's and probably not only for arts, for anything. I mean, why should you leave your computer where you feel comfortable to just go out and practice tennis? You know, that's the same thing for, or just learn how to be an engineer, you know, or whatever. I mean, it's for any learning process. I mean, these screens are a big, big, big issue. It should be used as a tool, and it's not a tool anymore. It's just, it's an abduction, you know, I think.
Mm-hmm. I imagine you teach a lot of adults, and are they using the banjo as kind of therapy, you know, to deal with the rest of their lives?
That's a really good question too. Yeah, I feel sometimes like a therapist when I'm teaching. I feel that people need to just forget about everything for an hour. And they learn things about music and they have fun. But I mean, yeah, music, it's for many of them is a way to just like, okay, forget about everything, the issue I have in my life. I have like, my younger student is 11 years old, my older is around 80. So you have like any, and of course they have different goals and different possibilities, because you know, when you start playing an instrument and you're later in age, the more difficult it is. I mean, I have many older students that are able to play with other people and to come to the jams, and it's a big thing in their life, I think.
Well, thanks so much for sharing your story and your music today. It was really wonderful to meet you.
Thank you. I hope I didn't speak too much. For some reason in my private life, I don't talk much, but when you give me a mic and allow me to speak, I'm fluent and sometimes a bit too much.
My job is to get you talking.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please do share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support the series, that would be wonderful. The link is in the description. Have a wonderful week.